podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
This month, Choice Cricket Centre are recruiting a new cricket bat maker for the Choice Willow brand of bats based in Redbourn, Hertfordshire. This is a unique opportunity for a passionate bat maker and cricket enthusiast to help promote, design and influence the future of their small cricket business into its third decade, whilst enjoying the ambience of their work environment within their indoor cricket centre. Short-term and temporary living space accommodation is available as part of the role. For more information, contact them at choicewillowrecruitment@gmail.com. Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We'll be revelling in Scotland's two World Cup wins over Bangladesh and Papua New Guinea, reacting to the England Lions squad announcement, the latest rejig in the county structure, the IPL final and much more. We also have an interview with Scotland left-arm spinner Mark Watt. I'm Yaz Rana and on today's show we've got Wisden.com features editor Tahir Hashim, who appeared in today's Guardian newspaper, if you want to get a copy of that, the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. Let's start with Scotland. Four words you don't often hear at the start of a cricket podcast. They're 2 from 2 in the T20 World Cup, kicking the tournament into life with that fantastic win over Bangladesh on the opening day, coming back from 53 for 6 to put on a total of 140, then defending it. Chris Greaves, in just his second T20I, was the player of the match, scoring 45 and taking 2 for 19 with his leg spin. Joe, it was really what this first stage of the tournament needed, wasn't it? One of the big two sides in the first round being in proper jeopardy early doors.
It did. It was a brilliant start, and it looked like it was going to be a bit of a damp squib of an opener at 50 for 6, as you described. And actually, at that point, I had plans for a little bit of Sunday. So I went off thinking, oh, that's just not a great way to start this tournament. And it's a bit of a funny way to start a tournament anyway, when you've got this kind of qualifier. And then I saw with about 6 overs to go, it was very much game on. And then Scotland wrapped it up beautifully. I mean, they've got a really well-balanced, versatile attack. Got a couple of hitters in there who haven't actually really... A couple of like Muncy hasn't really come off yet, but is a proper player. It's as you say, it's exactly what the tournament needed. And we've got another absolute, massive game coming up against Oman tomorrow, which, have I got it right, looking at the net run rate, Scotland basically need to win, assuming Bangladesh beat Papua New Guinea, Scotland need to win.
Yeah, that's right. So unless Bangladesh only just beat PNG and Scotland only just lose to Oman, Scotland need to win.
Yeah.
We've talked about Bangladesh a little bit, about they've secured some really big name bilateral wins. They beat New Zealand and Australia, but on really low scoring wickets where basically no one could get more than 120, 130. And Shakib actually said that careers will end because of some of these pitches. So I guess that wasn't great preparation. In their win yesterday, Bangladesh dropped Mamadullah and Mushrika down to number 7 and 8, which is just really strange. If you don't back them to bat in the top 6, why are they in the team? I guess Mamadullah has to be because he's the captain.
Mamadullah really rivals Quinton de Kock for the most reluctant captain I've ever seen. He does not look like he's enjoying himself at all.
Not with Flower of Scotland's being blared.
Oh, that was amazing. That was amazing. Yeah, if you haven't seen that video, basically Scotland after every game, after every win, they sing Flower of Scotland in the dressing room. But I guess the dressing room is quite near the room where they had the press conference in the Oman stadium, and Mamadullah just was completely silent for 20 seconds as Scotland were singing that next door, which is quite fun. Yeah, I mean, I'm biased because I'd lived up in Scotland for a few years, but I think that Scottish cricket fans, this means so much to them for a couple of reasons. So got that interview with Watt, and he describes this win as bigger than the England win, which everyone presumes is the biggest Scotland cricket win ever. I think part of it is because we spent half the summer talking about how England played too much cricket. Scotland have the complete opposite problem. They've only played 11 games in all formats from the start of the pandemic to the start of the World Cup. And I think the other reason why followers of Scottish cricket are so invested in their success is because the proximity between the recreational game and the national side. I was speaking to a couple of friends recently, and while you have, you know, Brad Wheel and Josh Davey, who've got full-time county gigs, a lot of them predominantly play club cricket and regional stuff. So I spoke to one of my friends yesterday who said, for me personally, it's just amazing and completely mental that as a bog standard club player, I get to play with and against these guys week to week. Take Munsey, for example, who's played county cricket recently. He was down at our club preparing pitches and coaching every week when he was in the country. He doesn't have to do that. These guys are properly part of their clubs. Mark Watt is a current club captain, which I think is pretty cool. So anyway, yeah, I spoke to Watt yesterday, so in between their, no, 2 days ago, in between their Bangladesh and PNG wins. He's been one of their star performers of the World Cup so far. Spoke, as well as their cricket, we briefly touched on his football, because bizarrely, I think I mentioned this pod once, I managed him in a game of football a few years ago.
It was him, was it? Excellent. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Does he remember that?
That was our first question. Actually, when I asked him, let's have a chat, he said, are we going to talk about my role as a deep line forward? So he remembered. here is that conversation.
Great to have you with us, Mark. Let's get the elephant in the room out of the way first. Technically, once upon a time, you played in a football team I sort of presided over. So I feel duty bound to ask you how your football's going.
Sadly, I've not been able to play too much football before we came over to Oman. I was a bit worried about some 50-50 tackles going against my way. So I put it probably about 3 weeks before we left. I put it to one side. But no, the left foot's still there. Still pinging in some nice cross balls and scoring some nice goals for the left peg. But I'll get back into it once the T20 World Cup's finished.
Yeah, if you're wondering, listeners, Mark was a very effective deep line forward. On to the proper stuff. We're talking 24 hours after that amazing win over Bangladesh. How are you feeling?
Yeah, just really proud. You know, you've seen social media over the past 24 hours just go absolutely crazy. And you know, it's just, I don't want to use the word unbelievable, because, you know, we believe that we can beat any team on our day, which we've shown in the past. So, yeah, it's just been a great start to the tournament. And, you know, we've had a really good about 6 weeks together now. And we're just keeping the ball going and keep the ball rolling, really. Keep winning games.
You were one half of that partnership that got Scotland back into the game. What were you and Chris saying out in the middle when you were six down with quite a few overs left? Do you make a conscious effort to be like, no, we're not just going to bat out the overs and leave something to bowl out? We want to put up a match-winning total.
Yeah, I went out to bat with Grievo and I just said, look, let's just give a couple of balls, see what the wicket's playing like, and then we'll go from there. We'll chat in a couple overs and then go from there, really, and just try to play each ball on its merits. And, you know, Grievo just thought about batting left-handed and hitting the ball at the park. But no, it was just... Yeah, just the wicket. You wanted to see what the wicket was doing first and foremost, and then kind of, okay, we've got used to the wicket and now we need to get a score on the board. We couldn't just, you know, just pat around and get 90 or 100 runs. We had to try and get a competitive total, and that's what we did. And our team bat right all the way down, right to 11. So we knew that people can come in and hit the first ball for six, like we showed with Safian and Josh Davey. So we're really... We just wanted to set up a platform for those boys to come in and do their thing.
Mm. Talk to me about Chris. His story is remarkable. I mean, as an outsider, he almost looks as if he's come from nowhere, effectively a complete newbie at international level, winning a Crunch World Cup game on day one. What's he been like, his rise, I guess, into the Scotland team?
It's been absolutely amazing. I absolutely love Grievo to bits. He's worked so hard on and off the pitch, just getting himself into the squad first and foremost, and to be on this trip. And you know, Shane Berger trusts him a lot and chucked him the ball and said, okay, in the practice match, go and show us what you can do for this team. And he did exactly that. I mean, I'm sure you saw on social media, you know, he was driving Amazon vans around 6 months ago, and now he's just got man of the match at World Cup. So it's a great story, and I'm so pleased for him, because he works so hard and he's a really, really top bloke. So yeah, really happy for Grievo.
Obviously, it's been quite a difficult 18 months or so for a lot of the smaller nations, in inverted commas, in the international game. I guess partly because it's the lack of cricket. How have you guys found the last 18 months or so?
To be honest, personally, I've just found it extremely frustrating. And you know, you see the test playing nations playing all the time. And if, you know, one thing they might be doing is playing too much cricket, and then you've got Scotland over here that are, you know, absolutely gagging for some games. And, you know, we just need to keep showing what we're capable of when we get given the opportunity on the big stage. So any cricket's welcome. You know, we're trusted bits to get Zimbabwe over to us for three home games, which was great prep for this tournament. But aside to that, you know, we've not played T20 cricket in years, which is just frustrating. And even before that, in the past 2 years, we've played 1.5 games of ODI cricket. So, yes, it's been frustrating. And, you know, seeing all these T20 leagues going on around the world, you know, we've got guys that can be competing in that and doing really well for teams in that. So, yeah, it's just been a frustrating past couple of years, really. And, yeah, we're just happy to be out here and playing well at the moment.
Something that non-Scottish listeners perhaps don't know that much about is how close the link is between the national team and club cricket in Scotland. You've played county cricket, but not for a couple of years. Am I right in saying you still play quite a lot for Heriots?
Yes, I'm captain of Heriots, yeah.
And a lot of the Scotland team, a good chunk of their cricket is Scottish club cricket. Do you want to just explain kind of how big Scottish club cricket is for the national team?
Yeah, it's massive. You know, it goes kind of club cricket, and then you've got the regional level, and then if you keep performing in both of them, then you'll hopefully get selected for the national level. And yeah, you know, boys are really passionate about club cricket. I am massively passionate about club cricket. I think, you know, it's great to be a part of, like, you know, it's like a family. And yeah, so if you're performing at club level in Scotland, you get the chance to play at regional level, and then you consistently keep performing at regional level, you'll hopefully get added into, you know, the Scotland training setup, and then you see how you go against the international players, and then you kind of go from there. And Grievo is a great example of that. You know, he's got runs at regional level, he's got a lot of wickets at regional level, and then he's came through the system, really, which kind of shows that it's working, which is really good for Cricket Scotland when you're producing players like that.
Interesting that you described it as a family. It really is like a big, close-knit family, isn't it? I only played there for a couple of years, but you get a sense that everyone's really invested in each other's success, if that's not too cheesy. Probably more so than I've seen down south, at least. The WhatsApp groups were popping yesterday evening.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I probably get the most abuse from anyone in my own team group chat. But, you know, everyone's wanting everyone to do so well. And, you know, when you've got such a great club team, kind of gives you that support that, you know, people are backing you and want you to do well. And it's just really good to have all that support. You know, it's not your family. They're not your family, but, you know, they care for you and they want you to do well, and seeing you on TV supporting, representing your country, you know, they get really proud. And yeah, it's a great thing to have.
Scotland don't play a huge amount of long form cricket at the moment. I was wondering how that has affected your development as a T20 bowler. It's quite lazy analysis, but a lot of people don't get too excited by finger spinners in T20 cricket, but you really caught your eye yesterday with the number of variations you had bowling from all over the place, behind the umpire, as wide as you could possibly go from the crease. Has being able to focus exclusively on white ball cricket helped you in a way?
Yeah, I think it has. I think it's also, you know, very tough as a finger spinner on the wickets that you get nowadays in national cricket. They don't do a lot for finger spinners. So it's just kind of just trying to keep the batter guessing, trying to keep them watching you all the time. And just any sort of advantage you can get as a cricketer. It might be a bit cheeky bowling from 25, 26 yards, but, you know, if it gets me a dot ball in T20 cricket, I'm going to try and keep doing it. But yeah, it's just, you know, white ball cricket for a finger spinner or any sort of spinner really is tough. Any sort of bowler even is really tough. You know, the game's only going one way and it's bigger sixes. So, yeah, it's tough. But any advantage I can get, I'll try them in the nets for a good year, 2 years, and then slowly bring it into my game. And, you know, it's worked quite well and something that I'm going to keep progressing, trying to get better at. And hopefully I can figure out some more variations for the World Cup.
Have you practiced that behind the umpire delivery quite a lot?
Oh, yeah. Everyone in the nets tries to hit it to the moon. so I was a bit scared bowling it in games. But, you know, it seems to work in games, you know, just because the batter is looking down at his toes and then looks up and then the ball's kind of halfway through the flight. So, you know, it's worked in games. So why not keep going with it? And hopefully it can only get better.
And just finally, can you give a sense of what yesterday meant for Scottish cricket? You were involved in that England win 3 years ago now, but this has got to be right up there with the best moments of the last 20 or so years.
Yeah, I think it tops the England win. Obviously, it was a great, great day of the England game, and, you know, it's their fierce rival of us. But, you know, World Cup, I mean, that means everything to us, you know, doing it on the big stage, you know, games that absolutely matter. And there's so much to play for, if it's finances, if it's just exposure, you want to be doing that in the World Cup. So, You know, yesterday just meant absolutely everything for us. You don't understand how much preparation we put into these games. You know, you've hardly played any in international fixtures. You've got 2 years thinking about this game against Bangladesh that you're going to be playing in the World Cup. So a lot of training sessions, a lot of, you know, bowling at the same batters all the time just in training. A lot of bowling at cones, trying to nail your Yorkers. Everything, all the 1%ers just going to yesterday. So it meant a lot for us boys.
Well, the hard work's paying off so far. Cheers for your time and best of luck with the rest of the tournament. Hopefully it's a long one.
Thank you very much, mate.
So talk to me about Curtis Camphor.
I don't think I've seen Curtis Camphor have a bad game of cricket for Ireland. Obviously, he turned up on the scene last summer against England. Scored a couple of half centuries, kept on getting rid of Tom Banton. And 4 wickets and 4 balls. And the two names he's joined on that list, I think, in immense T20 eyes. I don't know if it's across international cricket, Rashid Khan and Lasith Malinga. Now, Lasith Malinga, you can see how he might get 4 and 4. He'll just bowl 4 Yorkers and do that. Rashid Khan is, you know, can be unplayable. Curtis Camphor is a fantastic cricketer, but I don't think he ever saw himself taking 4 and 4 in a World Cup game in his World Cup debut. And it was just, it came out of nowhere. I think it was his second over. His first had gone for 12. And the first wicket was what initially called a leg side wide. Review shows a glove. And then he just went full, went in for the pads. Got 2 and 2. The hat trick ball, the first hat trick ball. Don't know how that wasn't given on the field. it was
absolutely
pretty
plum.
And then the fourth one, I think it was Van der Merwe goes for like a big booming drive, and I almost think if he's on strike for like an actual hat trick ball, like the first hat trick ball, he's maybe leaving that.
Yeah.
But he went for it inside edge, and Camphor goes.
Where do you stand on the double hat trick debate? Do you call 4 wickets and 4 balls double hat trick?
No.
No,
it's not, is it?
Well, I guess you could argue that the first hat trick is the first 3 balls, and the second hat trick is balls 2 to 4. Phil, you're silent on this one. Staying silent, okay. Moving on.
I mean, I could add some grist to that pointless mill, but I just don't need to.
Fair enough.
4 and 4. Let's just come with that and move on.
Patrick Noon asks, are you going to have to do another poll for the best T20 World Cup moment of all time after that Jatinder shot over extra cover against Shakib? That was a brilliant shot in the Bangladesh Oman game. But
it's such a shame he got out when he did as well. That game was looking really like another really good game there, and then it just kind of petered out.
They got some really good players, Oman. Jatinder Singh's been really good. Bilal Khan's been good, left-arm seamer. But Fayaz Butt was hitting 87, 88 miles per hour, and he was in the same Pakistan under 19 team as Bab Razam that got to the 2010 World Cup final. And in that final, Butt took 2 new ball wickets. Lots of like names you recognise. He got out Mitchell Marsh and Nick Maddison, and then the man of the match was Josh Hazlewood, who took a 4-4. Right. So lots of famous names there. Patrick's alluding to a poll that the ICC did, where they asked their followers online to vote for their greatest ever T20 Cup moment. The final was between Brathwaite's 4 sixes, remember the name, and Virat Kohli's 83 not out in a group stage game.
Can I guess which one?
Was that against Australia?
Yeah, it was a very good innings.
It was a good night. I remember watching that one live. Yeah.
We're currently recording this during England's second warm-up game before the campaign gets underway. They lost their first one against India, reasonably tight contest. Rahul, Kishan and Pant were very good for India. Tar, what's your moment of the week? It's from that game.
It was watching Moeen hit 30-something off, I don't know, 20-something, whatever it was. But it's the one shot that he plays, which I've really grown to enjoy over the watching him in T20 cricket. I've seen him do it a few times now. I think most famously it was against South Africa. So the ball will sort of be wide outside off full, and he kind of smashes it, but he slices across the ball so it goes behind square and can go for 6 or 4. I think he did it in the IPL final as well last week, and then he did it again in this warm-up. But the underlying point is that he's looking in very fine touch going into this tournament. And I don't think he's ever really had a great sort of like global tournament, really. I think he got 100 of the World Cup 2015 against Scotland. I mean, 2019, obviously, he was kind of dropped halfway through. And, you know, that was, you know, that wasn't a great tournament for him personally, I guess. But he's looking fine touch, and he's kind of, you know, he's the guy that he's got to be in that team now, which, you know, a few months ago at the start of the year, you kind of thought, how is Moeen getting in the side, especially when Sam Curran was, you know, in at number 7. But yeah, he's looking really good.
Owen Morgan didn't play the first game. He was out for about 10 today. He wasn't particularly happy with the umpiring decision.
With good reason, he middled it.
Yeah. Phil, Morgan said this week again that he would be willing to drop himself if his form, in his mind, was getting in the way of his side's chances of winning the World Cup. Do you think he should?
No, not yet. And I don't think he will. I think there'd have to be a real collapse. I think it would have to be a not just him not getting runs. I think it would have to be a kind of do or die moment. But then, paradoxically, the more pressure you move down the pipe of a tournament, and if you do need to find that win and it is a real clutch moment, then naturally you're going to want your skipper in there making the big calls. As we spoke about, I think maybe last week or a week or two ago, I think the captain's role in a T20 game is probably more pronounced and more central to the narrative than in any other form of the game. He does need runs, and he does acknowledge that. I listened to the press conference that he gave yesterday to a handful of the journalists, and you know he was relatively upfront about that. He also made the legitimate point. He said, "Well, I wouldn't be sitting here now if I hadn't come through every other run of bad form." And he does acknowledge that he is a flighty sort of feast or famine kind of player, so he does know that. He does need runs for sure. So do a few of them. Jason Roy. Ejaz Ahmed
was. I thought that as well.
Walked right across and got bowled neck and crop middle stump first ball. I don't think you saw it, Joe.
No, I missed that.
It's extraordinary. And he needs runs generally, I think.
Butler's looking reassuringly brilliant though, isn't he?
Well, I mean, Butler's a great player. Obviously, Milan is still ticking along at a run of ball, which, you know, gets lots of people very hot under the collar. Liam Livingston. You know,
he did okay against India.
He did okay. He got out cheaply in the second game against New Zealand, which we've just been watching. And again, you know, by no means are we concerned about him. A couple of bad weeks does not make you a bad player. But again, he would be feeling more comfortable, I think, in himself if he'd gone a little bit better. And I think the way that they were unable to contain India in that chase, and India knocked off 190 odd. With an over to spare. I mean, that's quite an easy win, really, in the context of a 20-over game. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how we're talking halfway through this game against New Zealand. So, yeah, there's work to be done, I think, across the board, really, with England. I just wanted to go back to the Morgan point. So, in this press conference, it was all very humdrum, to be expected, until a question was asked about Moeen.
Oh, yeah, this was bizarre.
And whether Moeen's good form... Well, Moeen is in good form, isn't that great, et cetera, et cetera. Is it in partly coinciding with him having walked away from the test game? And as soon as the question, rather garbled question, came out, you saw Morgan's face light up because it gave him the opportunity to say, and I quote, "Do you want to say that test match cricket was holding him back?" And that kind of glint in the eye, the Morgan glint in the eye, came through. And he never misses a trick, does Owen Morgan, just to reinforce the point that these are two very, very different games and that one is thriving and flourishing and buoyant and the other one rather less so. And he said he knew he'd been cheeky and he couldn't get the smile off his face. And then he kind of became more diplomatic and he said, well, you know, Mo's a very free-spirited cricketer, which again is kind of shorthand for the test game. He'd outrun the test game. But now he plays back with me in my lovely little subculture, then he can be happy and express himself and be successful again.
And crucially, having called it a day on Test cricket, even when he wasn't part of it, it was still kind of hanging over him, wasn't it, that question? And now that is gone, and it doesn't feel like coincidence that he effectively played the knock that turned Chennai Super Kings' total from a decent one into a match-winning one. On that final as well, we had that debate a few weeks ago about whether you could get away with a specialist T20 captain, and obviously this is important with Morgan now in such poor form. Well, that final had specialist captain versus specialist captain, effectively, didn't it? And it felt, watching that tournament, just experience is so important. And you watch Du Plessis, I know he wasn't a captain, but playing such a big knock, and I think Morgan's presence on the field is still so important. We had a good question actually from Neil Varani, who put it very succinctly, with which would you be happier to lose from England's T20 side? One, Morgan's captaincy. Two, Milan's batting returns. Or three, a fifth frontline bowler, which kind of sums it up really. And for me, it's three. I would lose the fifth, particularly against West Indies, which you expect is going to be a high scoring game. I would want that extra batter in there. So yeah, play them all and drop a seamer.
Also, just look back to 2016 with West Indies. Darren Sammy, you know, I don't think people remember Darren Sammy that much as a cricketer, but he was the captain that sort of, you know, he got that side in line, a very talented side in line to win that tournament. You know, so the template's kind of there.
And it's quite interesting in that press conference as well, when he said, if my form is getting in the way of the side's success and I'm aware I'm not getting any runs, he also said, as it goes, I'm captaining very well. That kind of made me think if he's captaining very well and he thinks he's captaining very well, I don't think he's going to drop out, especially when there are other players who are possibly out of nick as well.
And is it something you want to throw at Butler now? I mean, Butler obviously seems to be nailed on post-Morgan, but do you want to throw it to him in the middle of a world tournament where his batting is so absolutely pivotal to England's chances? Doesn't really make much sense to me. Yeah. And probably won't happen.
How are you guys feeling about England's chances? Has it changed much?
I think, was it you, Joe, who said maybe last week that you fear for England against West Indies in the first game? Did you say that?
I did, and I actually went as far as saying I thought England might not make it through the group. I think they probably will. I've changed my view on that, but I do think they'll struggle to get beyond the semis. I think they're kind of heading for a relatively comprehensive defeat to India in the semis would be mine.
Yeah. I mean, they do have power hitters, England. Of course they do. But it seems from what I've seen on these pitches, in these conditions, you need them more than ever before. And just as you saw the paucity of Bangladesh's batting as a consequence, really, of them not having power hitters, six hitters. The other side of the scale, of course, is the West Indies philosophy that, you know, you can see off three or four dots, provided you launch the fourth or fifth ball out the ground. And you need muscular players more than ever to kind of beef it over the boundary, because you're not getting much from the pitch. You're not getting much touch players. There's not much on offer for them, really, from what I've seen anyway.
Yeah, you mentioned Roy earlier. I think Roy's going to be really, really important. I think on the slower pitches, I think you've got to make the most of that power play as much as possible. And I think Roy is going to be really important to that.
I'm still kind of sort of gutted that they've not gone for an extra spinner. I still think they've kind of...
I agree. I think it's crazy.
The way India picked that squad, I know they've replaced now Akshar with Shardul, so they've got another seamer in there. But
it's still four spinners.
Yeah, so it's you know, it's who's misread the situation.
I think it's wild. Especially, you know, when balls do get slower and lower as well, and they scuttle under the bat and you have to create your own shots, your own pace on the ball. In these conditions, I just find it baffling, really.
And Livingston, people have gone on about, you know, him bowling off spin and leg spin, but he's still, at the end of the day, he is still a part-timer. I think... You just needed that third specialist in there somewhere.
He bowled quite nicely against India before he got injured. I'm personally okay with the makeup of the 11 if you've got Rashid and Moeen and Livingston. For me, it's just mad that you haven't got an additional seamer in there to change the side if you so wish on the morning of a match, if it looks like it's really going to turn and then you want a second specialist spinner. It's hard to work out how you could have got a second specialist spinner into this team who you'd have dropped to allow that to happen.
That's true. Mm. Yeah. I do hope they get Mills in there. He didn't play that first warm up, but just the way he bowled in the 100, you know, all the T20 stats, Skies have raved about him for years. But he's been, when you actually watch him, you totally get it. He's bowling 90 miles an hour, and then he knows exactly when to bowl the slower balls.
I get the sense that England have gone all in on a couple of players who I'm not sure they probably should have gone all in on. Darren Millan being one, and the other one being Chris Jordan. Chris Jordan's played so much for England and his record recently is really quite bad for England. I remember about a year ago we were talking about how Jordan saves his best performances for England. Absolutely not the case in 2021. He's going at about 11 in the death, and that's supposed to be his speciality.
And Mills could easily fill that role. Apart from, crucially, he doesn't offer the same in the field as Jordan. He doesn't offer the same with the bat. And he hasn't got that experience, which Morgan always raves about Jordan. I can't see him being dropped for the big games, even though I do think there is mounting evidence to suggest he's not actually in England's best 11.
Yeah, that's completely fair. Alex Brinton asked, with so much data and coverage available of all the teams in the T20 World Cup, could there still be a tournament dark horse? And if so, who do you think this is? I think that's a really good question, because I almost think that the data means you're almost more likely to have a dark horse, because you're almost... feel like the data tells you who should win, and you almost prematurely write off teams.
But Alex's point was that the teams who would historically be coming into a tournament like this as unknown quantities are now a lot more known. So that's his point, right?
Yeah.
It's a bit what used to happen with football when I first started watching world tournaments. There'd be all these players arrive you'd never heard of, and you'd think, God, these are such incredible players doing different things. But then they all ended up coming to the Premier League or La Liga, which you watch a bit of, or they play in the Champions League. And that kind of novelty has kind of worn off.
Yeah.
And I think you are starting to see that a bit more with cricket, just because there are so many T20 leagues around the world, or T10, and these names just become known. But for a lot of us, unless you're Ben Jones or Freddie Wilde, these are names. If we don't watch the Caribbean Premier League every week, then this is the first time you get to see them in the flesh playing proper international cricket against top players. Mm. That's exciting in itself to see what these names can actually do.
It does strike me that this tournament really is for these other teams. It's spiritually, it's for these other teams. But I think in the overriding sort of narrative or story of international cricket in the 21st century, it feels ever more that it's about these teams. Come down the pipe, you know, if it is an England, India or West Indies, Pakistan final, whatever, then great, sure, and we'll go round the process, and it'll be fun, and it might even feel significant at the time. But if a small team or a minnow team or an emerging team comes through and really does bother that last group section, and even possibly push one or two of the really big teams out, which I don't think is implausible from what you've seen, I don't think that's unrealistic, then that becomes a huge moment for the game, I think. And you're feeling now like, despite your boy legitimate concerns about having not played any cricket for the last 2 years, at this level, playing this format, the gap is narrowing ever more. And how great would that be for the game if in this form of the game, specifically in this form of the game, you can bring one or two teams through so they can legitimately sit on that top table and not feel self-conscious and not feel awkward and not be clinging and cleaving to the odd isolated win, but can actually say, we've got a crack side here. We've got a side that can do that, can bother teams on a regular basis.
And I think, but Scotland are a good example of this. Is not just a couple of teams doing well. This is now across the board. Scotland kind of scraped through the qualifier. I think they lost as many games as they won in their first group. Lost to Singapore. So now you're thinking, this isn't like in the days where Ireland might produce a shock, but everyone else was way off.
Yeah.
Now there are a bunch of teams who are capable of testing some really good the top sides, and that's really exciting.
Could I just ask, going back to Scotland briefly, you having lived up there and been involved in the Scottish cricket culture a little bit, if they were to obviously qualify and then beat another couple of big teams and not exactly get to the semi-finals, but to be in the scrap for that, what kind of impact might that have, and how much will the media and the sporting populace be interested in that, do you think?
It's hard to say because it has never happened. Scotland have never done well in a World Cup before.
What, in football you mean?
That was my favourite stat, that Scotland have won more.
I saw you did a viral, didn't you?
Yeah, yes. Scotland have won more cricket World Cup matches the last 4 days than their football teams have in the last 38 years. But going back to your question, it's hard to say because Scotland have never done well in a cricket World Cup before. There was a lot of press attention when they beat England, but that is so much to do with the Scotland-England rivalry, I think, rather than Scotland beating a big cricket nation. Cricket in Scotland is quite strange because in a way it is quite visible. There are cricket pitches all over the place, but it is kind of hidden and it's seen as very, very English. So I think they would have to basically beat England again or push England for, I think, to really, really
get
them.
They go into England's group, right? If they qualify?
Yeah. So that will be big, and there'll be lots of attention to that. But it would genuinely be unprecedented. So I have no idea what the press attention is, but normally very little.
They need to carve their own identity, don't they? Distinct from England. And it needs to become a game where your average Scottish sports fan will recognise one or two of these players. And then it's kind of diluted, the Englishness of it is diluted somewhat
in the way that
you develop your own identity.
In the way that Kevin O'Brien became the icon of that Irish win over England. We haven't probably quite got that yet with Scotland because it's still such early days. But.
Yeah, but I guess it's the same problem as we talked about with how to grow English cricket. It's all Sky. So like, it's quite hard for a casual sports fan to turn on the television and see, Scotland doing well. So it's quite hard, even if they qualify for the Super 12, and even if they get another scalp or two, I think that's still really difficult for that to like properly capture the Scottish public imagination. I think you'll see headlines, but I don't think you'll really see people, loads of people watching. It'll be great for the Scottish cricket community. And I hope I'm wrong, but I can't really see it suddenly making cricket an enormous game within Scotland. But yeah, that's a really good question from Alex. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week was going back to the first ever World T20 in 2007. I chatted to Darren Maddy and Chris Schofield, who are two quite kind of surprise picks in England's squad. At this point, we're only 4 years into the format played at professional level. Obviously, the first World Tournament. England up until then, I think, had played 5 games and didn't really have a clue what they're doing, or to be honest, particularly care. So they would basically pick their ODI team and then just muck around with the order a bit, like you might do on a Sunday at your club side. But then obviously with the first World Tournament, they thought, oh, maybe we should take this a bit more seriously, think a bit more about it, and picked a bunch of players who'd done really well in the T20 Cup. So Maddy, Schofield, Jeremy Snape came in, and there was another T20 specialist. Oh, Luke Wright as well, who was only 22 at that point, kind of got parachuted in. And I just thought I wanted to cover the story because Maddy and Schofield both had interesting England careers that weren't really. Schofield picked at 21 as a leg spinner, didn't bowl on debut, took none for 70-odd in his second test, and then never seen again, ends up bowling for Suffolk a few years later after losing his Lancashire contract. Then gets a deal with Surrey, and then a year later he's playing in a world tournament when he thought he'd never play cricket again. And then you've got Darren Maddy, who played a bit of test cricket, a bit of ODI cricket in 2000, same year as Schofield. Didn't do particularly well, got dropped, and then says he kind of lost his love for the cricket, had some mediocre seasons for Leicestershire. T20 came along, he thought, I'm not going to play that, it's a young man's game. And then ends up being one of the first sort of proper T20 players, the first player to score 1,000 runs in the format. And he said that absolutely rekindled his love for the game in general. And then he too, like Schofield, ends up playing in this world tournament.
They do okay as well.
They do. Those two do well. England kind of, fluff their lines, unsurprisingly. They beat Zimbabwe in the first game and then lose 5 games after that, most of them quite heavily. But yeah, Maddy has a quick 550 against New Zealand. Schofield takes a few wickets, doesn't go for too many runs. And then there's this kind of poignant moment, which they both referred to as England's ODI side went straight onto Sri Lanka for their ODI tour. So Schofield and Maddy were the only two players going their separate ways. They were on a plane flying back to the UK on the day that the final took place. So they didn't even see that. They didn't see this kind of earth-shattering, game-changing final. And they're both just sitting there wondering, like, what comes next? Is it anything? They're both kind of hopeful that they'll get another chance because they did quite well. And then neither of them play for England ever again. Maddy gets injured the next year, doesn't play much T20, and then it's basically quite old, 35, 36 by that point, so it doesn't come about. Schofield broke both his thumbs in 2 separate incidents the next summer, so barely plays. And then when he comes back, other players have emerged and he doesn't get another chance. Neither of them were at all bitter about this. It was more just a kind of an unfortunate finale to what was an incredible thing they never saw coming. So it really just struck me that whole tournament, everyone was still finding their way. No one took it particularly seriously. India 2 years earlier had voted against the tournament even taking place because they were worried about the effect T20 would have on the rest of the formats, which is pretty ironic given the context now. And then left Sachin and Ganguly at home. And then from then on, it's Dhoni's India, basically.
Yeah, wow. I mean, the early days of T20 cricket fascinates me. People having no idea what to do, basically, and getting random names in. That's really interesting.
Andrew Strauss batting at 7 in the finisher's role in England's first ever T20 international.
That's amazing. Your piece is on wisden.com. I'd highly, highly recommend it. It's a good read. Last week, feels like a long time ago, but England announced a 14-man squad for the England Lions Tour that will run alongside the Senior Squads Tour in Australia. The Lions will play 2 intra-squad matches with the England squad in Queensland. They will also take on Australia A in a 4-day match. The party will return home on December 16th. I'll run through that squad quickly. Tom Abel, Josh Bohannon, James Bracey, Bryden Carse, Mason Crane, Matt Fisher, Ben Foulkes, Alex Lees, Saqib Mahmood, Liam Norwell, Matt Barnson, Dom Sibley, Jamie Smith, Rob Yates. Tahar, any interesting inclusions or omissions for you?
I think it was more the omissions. I don't think there are any major surprises in there. Sam Cook was obviously the major one, the major talking point, I guess. So I mean, he just has an excellent first-class record. It's not even just this season that he's kind of broke out. He's been doing it for quite a few years now. He's been part of...
Got the best first-class record of the lot, including Overton, Robinson, and all the other seamers.
Yeah. Tom Haynes obviously had a kind of breakout season, so I thought he might get in there. But it's a pretty small squad. I guess that's intentional. And I don't know. After they'd announced them sort of main Ashes squad, this was actually going to be the more exciting one. But even then, it's not super exciting. I mean, the hope was to see Livingston in there. He'd be kind of that bolter, that sort of bring that sort of excitement factor. He basically would have become the talking point. Oh, can Livingston get runs there and get himself into the main Ashes squad? But he's not there, so it's kind of, you know,
I'm not
the reliable county operator.
I understand people's enthusiasm for him, but in this particular instance, I don't really understand that issue. I mean, he's not scored a red ball. I know his overall average is okay, but he says himself his red ball game has been sacrificed, in effect, to become a top-class white ball player. He says it himself. He's hardly played any red ball cricket.
And they've left Tom
Haynes. And the game is too difficult. It's too difficult. We've seen it time and time again. Red ball cricket is too bloody difficult to just sort of rock up and hope for the best.
I understand that point. And look, this is the running theme of English cricket and cricket in general, where you've got to pick your lane and you kind of have to go through it. But if it is the case now that Liam Livingston is going to be a regular part of these white ball squads, and during the summer he's going to not be able to play much county championship cricket, then if you do want to at least try and make that a possibility that he becomes a test cricketer, then it's got to be through England Lions. It's got to be through that, really. So that's my thinking, why you would have picked him. Obviously, yeah, I mean, his first class record, you're not picking him on that first class record right now because it's not been very good for a long time, but I don't know. There was an Ed Smith part of me that was kind of.
I completely understand what you're saying. You've got to carve out a route that essentially isn't really there and take whatever opportunities you can. But equally, when you've got Tom Haynes, who scored more runs in the championship than any other player and doesn't make the plane, you can see it would look a bit absurd if Liam Livingston, who's barely played and hasn't got a run when he has, did make the plane. Interesting pick for me was Alex Lees. Probably the next opening batter that we'll all be talking about as the one who has to come in when these guys get discarded. But he's got pedigree in the sense that he's been talked about for a long time. He's not just arrived on the scene. Got loads of runs early doors at Yorkshire, hugely tipped by Boycott as a future England opener. And then it all just went wrong as it does. Not quite to Hamid levels, but actually for a couple of years, not that far off. Went to Durham, and then you kind of wonder, is it one of those careers that's just going to slide away? And he's had a really good year, red ball and white ball. And I think, given how excited people were about him a few years ago, and given that the form has come back, I think he should be regarded as a serious option rather than just the latest bloke who's got a few runs in county cricket.
Mm. No, that's really interesting. On the Livingston debate, I do completely get it, because England aren't very good. That basically comes down to that. So when we were talking about last week how kind of boring the main squad was, or predictable, it's because England haven't won very much. None of the batters are getting the many runs. Some of the guys in the squad don't have great first-class records. So you kind of want to dream a little bit. And possibly Australia is the only place in the world where you could get a white ball guy in. It doesn't move as much. The pitches are true.
But we also agreed the other day that there are four decent middle-order stroke makers, in inverted commas, who are interchangeable for two spots. And if Livingston's ever going to play red ball cricket at the top level, it's going to be as a number five, number six. And that's one of the areas where England's current actual squad are relatively well stocked. I would also add that if we are looking for one more fantasy player in there, then I know Joe Clark had an in-out season, but Joe Clark's first-class record is better than Livingston's, and he's played a lot more red ball cricket of late and finished the season very strongly. Then, of course, there's the Vince enigma as well. You throw those kinds of names in.
Harry Brooks, who's actually had a good... I was surprised he wasn't there.
I mean, they are more legitimate cases to bat five or six in red ball cricket for England. I'd also add on your point, Taha, which I think is fair and logical, and if you are going to start him anywhere, then why not start him in the stiffs on flat tracks in Australia? I get that. Personally, I would say and he gave an interview to The Guardian, and he gave an interview to us, to our magazine, and he said Test cricket's still on his radar. for Livingston? Well, if it is, then say, right, year dot is the start of April next year, and go and play 9 or 10 games for Lancashire and see where you get to. See where you get to. Don't go and play the IPL. Go and, if you are serious about it, go and start from scratch from next year, and then we'll know. Then we'll know if he's got the game to transfer it from one to the other. At the moment, it would be a wild punt out of nowhere, I think.
Yeah, I guess it just isn't that wild, though, if it's just a Lions squad.
That's my thinking. I'm not saying put him in that main squad. It's more...
bang it through at the Gabba.
All right, well, if it doesn't matter that much, then why are we talking about it?
One other thing that I think is interesting, you're all right to mention that there aren't really any stroke makers in that squad. And Mo Bobat, the ECB performance director, when explaining the squad, said one of the things he has to do when picking a Lions squad is look at where the gaps might be in the England team in the short term. And you're right, there aren't any in 4, 5,
which
6.
Which is fair enough, which can be the only logic for why I say Sam Cook isn't in that Lions squad, because they've got a lot of other fast mediums.
And all the pace bowlers in that Lions squad are slightly quicker or very tall.
And not as good.
Yeah. moving on, the County Championship. The ECB has confirmed that from next season, the County Championship will return to two divisions following a vote by the 18 counties. This decision follows discussions between the ECB and the counties. There'll be 10 teams in Division 1, 8 teams in Division 2, 2 up, 2 down. I think this is really harsh on Notts, who finished third in 2021, but it will be in Div 2 because of where they finished 3 years prior. Joe, any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm a little bit torn on this because the Gloucester and Northants promotion was a great story, and they obviously worked so hard for it, against the odds, got there. It would have been great to see them Div 1, but that's heart over head. I think this is nonsense, really. I think the cricket is just too long ago. I don't think it can be based on that. And I think this was a reason to have another year of the conference system, so everyone was aware leading into the season exactly what you needed to do to get into Div 1. This is part of the problem, isn't it? They would be having to make up the rules after the tournament has happened. At least this way they can just kind of rewind. But I think squads have changed too much. It doesn't make sense to me. And my concern is that we end up having quite an uneven Division 1 next year as a result, because it's based on cricket that was, 3 years ago by the time you actually get down to it.
I guess Kent were the big winners here. They were in Division 3, and now they'll be in Division 1 because they finished fourth in 2019.
And I'm fine with that. But no, I mean, again, that's not right. Yeah, that's not right for
me.
And it's not a reflection of how good they are as a Red Bull team at this point.
Absolutely. Tar, what do you reckon?
I mean, I was just wondering if there's been any explanation as to why they couldn't just use last season's standings.
But basically, because the argument they used was in 2019, the teams knew that performance in this competition will influence the next season's league, which division you are the year after, but they didn't know this year, is basically the argument.
But that
bit of common sense would have been required, though, for a lot of clubs, because they had to know that the wind was taking the game back towards this, and that there was going to be a very decent chance that it was going to be based on what's happened this year, as on balance it should have been. There's also that kind of tacit element of, well, they weren't really trying, and the whole thing was a bit of a farce.
It's an admission,
and
we've
just overwritten the integrity of this whole summer.
It's an admission that the final stages of the summer
were
just
a
meaningless,
waste of time,
which we've been talking about, and now it's sort of almost laid out there for us.
Yeah, but a little bit of foresight from a coach or a skipper, or even the ECB themselves. All it would have required was a word or two to say, look, you know, this should become relevant, and it might become relevant over and above the simple fact of playing the game, which of course should be enough anyway.
There must have been at least one county captain or coach who was saying that.
Yeah, you would absolutely think so.
Let's give it a try today, guys.
I'm glad they've gone back to two divisions. I wouldn't have delayed it another year, as you say. I just think you'd have been kicking the can down the road a little bit, and I think next year would have suffered a bit as well from that lack of jeopardy. That said, I think it's faintly ridiculous that we are leaning on results that will be literally 3 years old by the time we get round to next year.
But the best thing about this news is that it means we don't have to talk about the county structure for at least a month or so.
Yeah, that's true.
They'll probably rejig the Royal London One Day Cup soon, and we'll have that to talk about.
That should be a special episode, though, right? Yeah. In its own right.
Talking to the icons of the Royal London One Day Cup era. So it's been a while since we talked about Azeem Rafiq on the show. We've had a few questions in about him recently. Newer listeners might not know this, but you were the one who broke the story 14 months ago. You talked to him again recently. How is he? What are the latest updates?
Well, I think the main update is that he's seen a redacted version of the report. Obviously, Yorkshire released that summary of the report, the morning of that test cancellation in September. Azeem's seen the redacted version. What can I say? I mean, I should say that last week I remember seeing this Twitter post, obviously by Yorkshire, as part of National Hate Crime Awareness Week, and there was a part of this post on Twitter. There was a picture of, you know, a flag hanging outside Headingley that said "Challenge it, report it, stop it." I mean, it was, you know, I don't think the irony was lost on a lot of people. It's it was mocked by a lot of people, and it kind of reminded me of something Yorkshire did last year before Rafiq had made any allegations were public, where on their shirt they said they were going to wear a badge that says "Yorkshire cricket supports diversity." I mean, these kind of messages, these PR drives, they don't really mean anything when you're actually so resistant to actually confronting the problem when it's actually time to. I mean, it's now been more than a month since the club dropped that summary of the report, and it admits that Azeem Rafiq had been a victim of racial harassment and bullying while a player at the county. It showed that racist language was used by former players, by a former coach. August 2018, it was shown that, you know, Azeem Rafiq raised concerns of racism and the club didn't investigate it. And yet all these weeks later, we still don't really know what's going to happen next. We don't know if these people in the report are being held accountable. You know, I asked the ECB yesterday if they've yet to receive the report. I'm still waiting for an answer. I mean, right now it kind of seems like the only person who seems to be suffering from all of this is the man who it's been proven was the victim. And look, he's been vocal and he's said it publicly now that how much faith he's lost in the powers that should be supporting him. Can anyone blame him? Kind of what this whole situation over the last 14 months, last year, what it kind of continues to show is that, you know, all of us in cricket, all of us in English cricket, we kind of want to talk about, we've been talking a good game for the last year about how we want to confront racism in cricket. But if it gets a bit too uncomfortable, people, you know, when it's actually time to confront it, people don't really, they don't want to talk about it. It's, you know, a month ago, you know, you say it out loud, a month ago, Yorkshire Cricket, County Cricket Club admitted that a player had been racially abused at the club, and all we've kind of got since then is kind of silence, and it's kind of like, oh, that happened. No one really knows what's going to happen next, and that's kind of frightening, really.
And Rafiq released a statement in response to Yorkshire's statement summarising the report, in which that he brings it up. What are the consequences for the people who have been found to use this language? And he also said, I want to see the whole thing so I can basically make sure that everything's factually correct.
Yeah.
And presumably when the ECB do get the report, if they do get it, it will still be the heavily redacted version. So we're still going to be stuck in this limbo.
I think that will be the case though. I think the ECB have been pushing for the full report. And as of now, I mean, you've tried to get confirmation of this, but my understanding of it is that as of now, they still haven't received that report. And it's very much up for question what kind of version of the report they will finally get, if they get one. I know they are increasingly apoplectic, really, in the ECB's offices regarding this. And look, you know, the biggest county and the governing body, you can see this getting quite heavy duty, I think, maybe even ending up in the courts potentially.
Yeah, because there's a sense that we need to hear more from the ECB on such a serious matter, but they have been hampered by Yorkshire, and
yeah,
there's not much more they can say at this point.
Yeah, that is
the
fair.
Interesting thing will be when they do get the report, redacted or not, that will at least be the next stage, and then it's over to the ECB really to decide what action needs to be taken.
And in the midst of it, I mean, what was your impression of how he was coping?
Well, the main thing is that he's just lost a lot of faith in, you know, what the system is, right? And what the system should be, and it should be there to protect players. And it says it's there to protect players, but is it really?
Yeah, the PCA as well, you know, which is in many ways an admirable organisation. They are in a bind as well, and I know a few people there who are on the front line of it and so on. And the problem that they're facing is that they're rather neutered, if you like, because due to their mandate of looking after all the players. Now, what that means is that they can try and extend their duty of care to Azim Rafiq, and I know that they've been talking to him regularly, but that also means that the same principles have to then be applied to those people who have been implicated in the report itself, because they're also ex-players, and they'll all be members of the same organisation, the union in effect. And so you can absolutely understand where Azim Rafiq's frustrations are coming from with these institutions that run so much of English cricket, because he must be feeling incredibly isolated out there. You know, it's devastating. It's devastating on the boy, and it's a devastating indictment on the game, as we know. You just hope that he can hold himself together until he gets some kind of clarity and resolution. And I think it's important that we sit around this table, and it's important that other outlets do the same, and that they continue talking about this, because there'll be lots of people out there that will be very comfortable if this story just drifts away, withers on the vine, and we can't have that. We cannot have that.
Mm. Absolutely. We'll keep talking about it on this show, that's for sure. Very big, big gear change. The IPL final happened this week. We mentioned it earlier, but MS Dhoni, CSK took the title, beating KKR in the final. Faf du Plessis hit 86. Moeen smashed a quick fire 37. I just wanted to mention the second qualifier game, which feels like a long time ago. One of the most amazing finishes to any game of cricket I've ever seen. Chasing 136, KKR were 123 for one with 4.1 overs to go. 23 balls later, they were suddenly 130 for seven. With two balls to go before Rahul Tripathi hit the fifth ball of the final over for six.
Yeah, it was Ravichandran Ashwin to drag one down. Bowled him a dirty long hop with a ball to go. Interesting, though, that we got through like the best part of 55 minutes on this show before you mentioned the final of the biggest domestic tournament in the world by miles, which you would think should be nearer the top of the show, but it's kind of indicative of the of circus of element. Maybe of us. Maybe simply of us. But the instant forgettability of so much of you know, the merry-go-round.
But I forgot.
2 days later, the same players are playing warm-up games.
But it's also indicative of the fact that the IPL finishes the day before a world tournament starts. I mean, that, and the IPL starts in 2 months, right?
Early next year, yeah.
When you... When you said we're going to talk about the IPL final, I was like, that was months ago.
It was also a rubbish final.
Yes.
It was. Yeah. Although I did enjoy Faf's knock. Yeah, I've always had a soft spot for him. I think he's a really good bloke. I've interviewed him a couple of times. He's always been lovely and kind of interesting character in the story of cricket. You kind of forget that he's still ticking along, but still doing the business. He got the orange cap. Or he might have even finished a run short. He finished a run short of getting the orange cap. But anyway, it was a brilliant, brilliant knock. And quite watchable as well. And he's not always the most watchable of players. I really enjoyed that final, actually, I have to say.
I mean, genuinely, on how much we talk about the IPL, listeners, if you think we should talk about it more next year,
tell us.
Genuinely tell us.
Is there, and I'm aware I'm putting my head above the parapet slightly here, CSK aren't a particularly lovable side, right? There's not a great story. I mean, I was pleased for Moeen, obviously, but they're really old.
Yeah, I think you'll find quite a lot of people like Dhoni in India, at least.
Yes, that is true. That is true.
And I guess it was interesting that...
But it's also not that interesting. I suppose it is interesting, a story that he's pulled it off.
Yeah.
And
they were really bad in the year before, from a cricket point of view.
I put so much into the first leg of the IPL, I wasn't really ready to give it more when the second leg came around.
I think if we transposed our sort of irritating, hipsterish, metropolitan elite credentials and really threw ourselves at Indian cricket, then I think CSK would probably be my least favourite team, because they had the big scandal, didn't they? You know, and there's that sense of entitlement, and you know, they were banned for 2 years and were resurrected, you know, on a technicality and all of that, and now they're winning it all again. Yeah, I'm not sure they'd be my first team. But yeah, I probably lost a few fans on that one. You might want to scrap that one.
Let's move on.
Keep that in.
Yeah, sure.
By the way, let's move on. elsewhere, today, this morning, Australia quick James Pattinson announced his retirement from international cricket at the age of 31. He played 21 tests, taking 81 wickets at 26. He's only played 4 tests in pretty much the last 5 years, which is actually pretty big news for the Ashes.
Sorry, this was an injury thing again, because he's not playing in their upcoming Shield game, is he?
And he basically said he thought it was too much for him to get to a place where he could play test cricket. So he wanted to make the decision of basically, I can spend more time with my family, I can maybe play a bit of cricket in England.
That's a sun bowler to have that kind of small record, isn't it, really? I mean,
I think he made
a fair wind for a bowler of that kind of quality, and he could have been anything.
I think he made his debut alongside Mitchell Starc or something about 10 years ago now.
Yeah, I think
21 tests or something. It's quite sad for a bowler who's that good. I'd recommend people find the clip of him bowling in grade cricket.
Oh, I was thinking that this morning.
Astonishing. It's
terrifying.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
But it's the one where he gives the kid a send-off.
Yeah, I don't think he's a kid, but it's just it's beautiful. Beautiful thing to watch. Yeah,
he's bowling far too fast. Yeah, Saturday afternoon. Too fast, yeah,
and I think Siraj Randeev, who used to play for Sri Lanka, at slip.
Good side.
What a link. Phil, what's your moment of the week?
Well, a bleak one. Harvey Hussain, the very good Derbyshire keeper batsman, has retired from the game, age 25, due to a series of concussion head injuries, and after a kind of extended, sustained series of analyses with the staff at Derbyshire and a neurologist as well, they have come to that conclusion that it would be just simply too dangerous for him to continue playing at a professional level. And so he has had to make the incredibly difficult decision. And he's made the decision himself. He's not been pushed out. This is a percentage-based decision, if you like. And the club's chief exec said, in all likelihood, his decision has prevented another injury surfacing, and obviously potentially serious consequences for Harvey himself. This story, I mean, you know, our sympathies go out to the lad. You know, it must be horrific. He played at 18 for Derbyshire, took, I think, 9 or 10 catches or something in his first game. He was a homegrown player, highly regarded. He'd had a good career. And then just as you're getting to the meat of it, you've got to go. It's brutal. Brutal for the lad. But the broader point is that concussion in cricket, just as many sports are having reckonings with themselves, it's only going to get a bigger story, this. And I think down the line, I think it's inevitable that there will be changes to the game. I really do. I think at some point down the line, I think as much as it sounds awkward coming out of my mouth, I think that bouncers will probably have to be banned in the end. I think before the final run of this game, I think that health and safety issues are so pronounced now in all sports, and I think cricket is reckoning with itself. And I do genuinely think that eventually that decision will have to be taken. It becomes a financial thing as well. The NFL settled 8 years ago in 2013, they settled a $765 million series of lawsuits with various American football players who had shown to have neurological damage post retirement. $765 million. That was a watershed moment for other sports as well, and cricket has had its own tragedies, as we know, of course, and the Philip Hughes tragedy followed not far on from that. I think 2015 it was, maybe, or 2016. And you're now seeing the game slowly confront the issue. Obviously, concussion substitutes are now an established part of the game. But even with that watershed moment with Marnus coming in halfway through that Lord's Test match, you still had the shocker of Steve Smith having been felled by Joffre Archer and then resuming an hour or so later. I mean, well-meaning by the by the medical staff, but a shocking decision and indicative again of a game that's not really up to date with this ongoing and increasingly significant issue. You have Pukowski, the Australian opening bat, who's I think had 9 separate concussions,
and just this week had further concussion symptoms. So as a precaution, he was taken out.
Yeah.
Nathan Lyon had minor concussion this week as well.
Yeah. This subject is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Last year, we talked about this on the pod. Malcolm Knox, an Australian writer, wrote basically what you're saying now, that he thinks the bouncer should be outlawed. You're saying that you just said that you think that it will be. Do you think it should be now?
I can't say that yet. I don't have the strength of conviction to say that. And the consequences of that for the game, and it will apply obviously more to the Red Bull game, are quite big, existential, possibly.
They are, but then, and it sounds like it would be a different sport entirely, but as you say, other sports have faced this reckoning and have changed. American football and rugby, which are games that I vaguely follow but not closely, as I understand it, have changed, I mean, quite fundamentally in some aspects in what you're allowed to do and how you can do it. Cricket shouldn't think it's above that it somehow has kind of special status, that the bouncers are so significant that the game continues. That, and I agree with Phil, I can't get to the point where I say bouncers should be banned, because I'm not sure if there is even the medical evidence to suggest that is worthwhile, that percentage wise. That, and you can ban a bouncer, there are still other ways of getting concussed on a cricket field. I just fear more and more for umpires the more I watch them. I think Bruce Oxenford's thing, the protection thing, which a few people had a bit of a laugh about at the time, I think that is really sensible.
Totally.
These umpires don't have the reaction speeds of the cricketers they're officiating. I think it's a matter of time before someone gets really
hurt. Bowlers in their follow through in that as
well. Yeah.
Well, this is true. I mean, there was obviously that Luke Fletcher horrifying moment when he was clanged from a straight drive. I think it was Sam Hain who hit it. And yeah, Nathan Lyon, you mentioned, it wasn't batting, it was in the field where it was a mild concussion, I believe, but he was hit on the head. I mean, there remains, of course, the issue of machismo and how you overcome that in the game. And obviously, you no more macho game than, say, rugby, and that's had to try and wrestle with the vocabulary around the game and evolve its attitudes around the game as well. And cricket will have to try and cross that Rubicon as well.
Yeah,
I remember Beefy saying during that Lord's Test match with the concussion substitute, and he says, "Well, we may as well use a tennis ball," you know. And it doesn't sound like him. It's a beef line, and yet there will be many, many people who love the game who will be saying the same kind of thing, and so this is the challenge that the game is going to have to, I think, in the end, confront. How do you maintain the spirit of it and keep people with it while also evolving with the times?
Yeah, so I genuinely think that if you don't, you could do something that doesn't completely outlaw the bouncer, but you could significantly reduce it and basically treat a bouncer like a beamer, where if you bowl something that's genuinely at a batsman's head, you get an official warning. So you can still bowl reasonably short stuff, but you can't bowl something direct at someone's head, and that's up to the umpire. I don't think that'd be a significant change to the game. It would make it slightly safer for the batter. But yeah, as a starting point rather than just outright banning it. But yeah, that is all interesting.
All kinds of levels to it as well. Sorry, I mean, pitches as well. I can understand where you're coming from there. But if you look, say, at the footage, the 76 footage of Brian Close and Michael Holding, they weren't trying to knock his head off. They landed just short of a length, and it was just flying past his face because the pitch was corrugated and up and down. Joe and me have been writing about great half centuries of the century for our 50th issue of WCM. And a lot of them are these kind of rear guard games on filthy corrugated pitches where you're wearing one on the elbow, one on the shoulder, one on the grill. And bowlers are not going after these batsmen, but the pitches are so up and down that it's kind of an occupational hazard. But then, of course, there's the other element that we're writing these things up and kind of celebrating the heroism, the glory of it, and sport in its most primal form is, of course, some of the most memorable and sustaining and significant.
You ask people to pick out their favourite cricket photograph, how many of them are going to be a batsman leaping in the air with his head thrust backwards trying to get out of the way of a bouncer? I mean, that is what, for a lot of people, Test cricket is about. And
there's another question. I don't know if you're planning to get to it. If you are, sorry about this. But they said, name me some other great YouTube clips from the past. Are you going to get to this? Yeah. All right, well, before you do, a lot of us would instinctively tell that person about those occasions when a batsman and a bowler have been going hammer and tong at one another, and it's cricket as played in the raw and on the edge.
Mm. Well, let's get to that question. I know he's asked a question before, but Shervo has sent in another cracker.
They're just too good.
If you've forgotten about David Shervington, aka Shervo, he wrote to us a few weeks ago about his favourite moment of the summer, in which he explained that he's relatively new to cricket, in that he only started properly following it at the end of the 2018 summer. So he's got in touch again and he's asked, I've been enjoying Felix White's book, and as well as being a beautiful walk down musical memory lane and a powerful memoir of personal grief, it's been a useful primer and key moments in relatively recent cricket history that I missed because I was too busy stupidly not liking cricket for most of my life. Reading his vivid description of Donald bowling to Atherton in 1998, I immediately went to YouTube and spent a happy few minutes experiencing it for myself for the first time. So my question is, what other iconic cricketing moments does the panel think I should be looking up on YouTube and reliving during the winter months? That's amazing, though, that anything be 2018, that's new to him.
I'm quite jealous.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think first...
You know, it's when you hear about a great box set and you can get to go and watch it and everyone else has enjoyed it for the first
2005
time.
Ashes box set, talking of box sets. Well, that'll sort you out for three hours.
That's on YouTube as well.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. It is on YouTube.
For myself, my favourite tournament in cricket really is the World Cup, 50 over World Cup. So, you know,
all of them. Okay. You should just go and watch all of them.
Every single from the
just
first
watch
game.
All the World Cup shirts.
Right from 79 to 90.
He might have more. I don't know if he's got that much time. Perhaps
all right,
he has.
Narrow it down. So
World Cup?
The 92 World Cup is obviously the watershed moment. So, yeah, Shervo, go and watch the 92 World Cup. I think there is a YouTube video, in effect, the 100 greatest moments of the 92 World Cup. And I had that actual VHS when I was a kid. And that is a beauty, from just Azharuddin just playing a cover drive against South Africa to, you know, Phil de Freitas cleaning up Peter Kirsten in the semi-final, whatever it might be. Just individual moments from that great World Cup.
Similar to Donald to Atherton, that's from World Cup. Wahab Riaz to Shane Watson, 2015.
Yeah, good one. Taha just wrote about for the magazine,
yes,
actually.
Yeah.
So you should read that too.
You should read
World
that
Cup.
As well.
World Cup.
99 World Cup was the Australia South Africa game where Warne got a three for the finish to the semi final. I think got to watch that.
Yeah, don't bother watching England in that tournament. Yeah. might not be much out there.
Yeah,
one triggered for me because he mentioned Atherton, and all, it just sums up that cricket is largely heartbreaking. Was Atherton's run out at Lords 93? I think that's a good lesson in how horrible this game can be. That was only my second day of live test cricket after 99, coming back for the run that would complete what would end up being his only 100 at Lords, and slips and falls, and just watch it for yourself. And then another 99, which I've just been writing about for the feature that Phil mentioned, Alex Tudor, 99 not out, Edgbaston, 1999. One of those knocks that just shouldn't really happen, but he's thrown out there just to block out a few deliveries at the end of the previous day, and that goes on and wins a test match for England at a time when they didn't win too many. So that there's some good highlights of that as well. So I'd recommend that one.
It's a very broad question, isn't it? He's basically asking what was good in cricket before 2018, before September 2018.
Or bad in cricket.
Or bad, that's true. I've talked about Scotland already, but I'd highly recommend the highlights of Scotland beating England, just for the pitch invasion at the end, really. At a very small ground in Scotland, would recommend that. Phil, any more?
I spent a whole afternoon in lockdown watching Australia v West Indies home test matches from the late 70s, early 80s. And CA, Cricket Australia, they have all this footage and they plonk it all on YouTube. So it's really good. And Viv makes 100 in one game. There's a load of footage of that. Dennis Lilly cleans them up, takes 10 for in one game, wins one of those games. but there's loads of it. And it's also, it's just the daily highlights. So it's the half hour in the evening Channel 9 highlights. So a lot of it's rubbish. A lot of it's just, you know, some, like, you know, Bruce Laird gets 40 odd in 180 balls.
Did you watch the lot, or were you fast
forwarding? I spent a whole afternoon, you know. it was during the pando, wasn't it? So lockdown stuff. So I'd recommend that for sure. Also, Pathé News, type in any kind of test match from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Type in England, West Indies, 1963, Lords, for example, the great test match. And then Pathé News has got those daily roundups. And I think they're also on the Lords website as well, so it's not all on YouTube. But if you want to kind of learn about some of the grainy old black and white stuff, then, yeah, type in any of those games, and generally Pathé News have got that covered as well.
I think there's a lot on the ICC website.
Yes.
You want.
Yeah.
I think they released a lot of things over 2020. So
yeah.
Anything with Mark Waugh. Anything at all, even just him sort of walking to the shops, anything at all with him.
In all seriousness, just there's a bloke called Robolinda 2 on YouTube. Find his YouTube channel, and he's this archivist who's got footage that I don't think anyone else really owns.
The most important man in cricket. We
had him on the podcast during lockdown.
He's got to be top 10.
That's probably the most excited I've ever been for an interview, bizarrely, because I had no idea what he's going to be like. So I direct you over there. We have another question from George. He has said, I'd love to know the pod's thoughts on the possibility of having different white ball and red ball head coaches from the national sides. The thought first came to my mind when I saw a video of Ricky Ponting speaking excellently in the Delhi Capitals changing room after their qualified defeat in the IPL. It was commented upon how it is a shame that coaches like Ponting, love him or loathe him, are unlikely to become national coaches because of the grueling schedule and time away from family. Clearly, when it comes to different captains with different formats, this is not an issue and is pretty standard, so I do not see why it cannot be replicated with coaches. In my mind, Trevor Bayliss was a white ball coach and Chris Silverwood is a red ball coach. So why not get them to focus on what they're good at? Don't have to spend ages on this, but what do you think?
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. I think it will go more that way as well. There are a host of reasons for it, but the different formats becoming more and more different, I think, is up there with the best of them. England have been burnt in the past with this. They obviously had the Giles Flower. It was Giles Flower, wasn't it? Giles doing the one-day stuff. Flower in the test team didn't really work particularly well, and there will always be that friction between the formats, but we kind of have that anyway. I'm not sure it's going to be that much worse if you have different captains. Might even be better in some ways.
But it's interesting though that the central contracts have actually tried to blur the lines even more. Yeah. They're kind of like pink contracts now, and they are trying to keep the thing as homogenous as they can now. Now, I tend to agree with you on balance, but I can imagine that the conversations going on in the England setup, at least, are ones of different agendas, different competing power struggles, and, you know, Morgan understandably wanting to have his white ball stuff exactly as he wants it, and Joe Root straddling all the different worlds, but still being, of course, the Red Bull captain, and then you have now Silverwood, who is overlord of all of it. And Giles is overlord of him. And if they were to silo the thing more, which I think would result in a more effective group of teams, but there would also be even more challenging issues from a sort of diplomacy perspective and dressing room cohesion and so on. There would be even more of an issue because naturally, if you're the Red Bull coach, you'd be saying, what the hell are you doing? Why are my boys playing? Why aren't I getting the same team out every single week? This is, it's a very ECB way of doing it.
And that's what happened with Flower and Giles, and Flower on the conversation every single time, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
But, so it's
and Giles acknowledged that, didn't he, at the time? He said, tried it, didn't happen.
And also, we didn't really like white ball cricket in this country at that point, so there wasn't really an argument to be had. Now it's much more complex. Yeah. I still think overall it's a good thing.
It could be dictated by the calendar. I mean, look at India. This summer where they had that whole separate squad in Sri Lanka and then the whole separate thing in England, and then you have to have someone else, you know, running that ship. When England did it was a stage, like Joe's saying, where, you know, there wasn't that much of a difference between the white ball side and the red ball side. I mean, if we get to the stage where, you know, this is the prediction that people are making, where you have completely different teams, then I think that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the point from George that I really like is that if you have one coach across all formats, you're restricting who you can get as your coach, because so few coaches nowadays, especially ones who do any kind of T20 stuff, the idea of working so much across a year when you could have the franchise gigs pick when you work doesn't sound that appealing to them. So you might just restrict the pool of people available to you, which I think might eventually mean they split them up.
Meanwhile, Adil Rashid's bowling really well.
I know, I completely lost my train of thought there.
I know, I'm just looking at both of you kind of drifting, your eyes drifting above my head.
Just finally, a shout out for the a change to the wisdom.com shop. From this week, there is free UK shipping, excluding Northern Ireland and the Scottish Highland and Islands, on all orders over £50 from the Wisdom shop.
If you're in the Shetlands, you're buggered. You can't get anything.
Yeah, afraid is not free shipping.
To get to the mainland.
Yeah, afraid so. But that means that there's free shipping on our limited edition Andrew Redding collection featuring some of England's most loved grounds, which if you haven't seen it already, I'd highly, highly recommend.
Yaz, I want to jump in because we got another lovely email, which I knew you wouldn't read out because you don't like to make it all about
you.
Oh, you're
going to do it.
Oh, this is embarrassing.
So this is from Phil Robson, or Mr. Robson, to you, Yaz. Hello, Yaz and the team. Loving the podcast. Long-time listener, first-time emailer. I don't have any moving stories or elegant deep questions, but I'm feeling very proud of Yazeen. I was his tutor at St. Paul's School between 2009 and 2012, and vividly remember our chats about the best game in the world and upcoming stars, including one whom I forget the name of, but was playing for Surrey Academy at the time. The boy done good, as they say. I admit I started listening to the pod after learning the boy Prodigy was hosting, but keep coming back because it's compelling, thoughtful, elegant journalist speaking sense. Hear, hear. Now that I live in America, Wisden is about 90% of what I consume in terms of cricket. The other 10% is Felix White and his mob. Keep up the great work, Phil Robson. Oh, isn't that nice?
What a lovely message. Yeah, I remember basically spending every morning for 3 years at school just talking about cricket with Phil, and it was great.
Who's your favourite Phil, Yaz?
Well, it's got to be Robson. And I think, the Surrey Academy player that I would have been obsessed with in 2012 would probably be Zafar Ansari, I think.
Who later appeared on the podcast. This
exactly,
is just,
it's yeah, full circle, yeah. Full circle. It's all happening. Anyway, that's all we have time for. It's another very, very long podcast. Cheers, Tar. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Phil. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast, and we'll be back next week.
Podcast Network.